I used to think of this as standard Greek behavior until I realized that ours was the only car in the church parking lot consistently swarmed by bees. My father hid peaches in the trunk. He hid pastries in the tool shed in the laundry room and then wondered where all the ants were coming from. Open a cabinet in the master bathroom, and to this day you will find expired six-packs of Seago, a chalky dietary milkshake popular in the late 1960s. Crowded beside liquefied nectarines and rock-hard Kaiser rolls, the cans relax, dented and lint-covered, against the nastiest shaving kit you have ever seen in your life. There are those who attribute my father's hoarding to being raised during the Depression, but my mother was not one of them. Bullshit, she used to say. I had it much worse than him, but you don't see me hiding figs. The reference to figs was telling. My father hid them until they assumed the consistency of tar, but why bother? No one else in the family would have gone anywhere near a fig, regardless of its age. There were never any potato chips tucked into his food vaults, no chocolate bars or marshmallow figurines. The question, asked continually throughout our childhood, was, who is he hiding these things from? Aside from the usual insects and the well-publicized starving people of India, we failed to see any potential takers. You wouldn't catch our neighbor scraping mold off their strawberries, but to our father there was nothing so rotten that it couldn't be eaten. It was people who were spoiled, not food. It's fine, he'd say, watching as a swarm of flies deposited their hatchlings into the decaying flesh of a pineapple. There's nothing wrong with that. I'd eat it. And he would. If the price was right. And the price was always right. Because she fell for words like fresh picked and vine ripened, our mother was defined as a spendthrift. You couldn't trust a patsy like that, especially in the marketplace. And so, armed with a thick stack of coupons, our father did all the shopping himself. Accompanying him to the grocery store, my sisters and I were encouraged to think of the produce aisle as an all-you-can-eat buffet. Tart apples, cherries, grapes, and unblemished tangerines. He was of the opinion that because they weren't wrapped, these things were free for the taking. The store managers thought differently, and it was always just a matter of time before someone was sent to stop him. The head of the produce department would arrive, and my father, his mouth full of food, would demand to be taken into the back room, a virtual morgue where unwanted food rested between death and burial. Due to the stench and what my mother referred to as one small scrap of dignity, my sisters and I rarely entered that back room. It seemed best to distance ourselves, and so we would pretend to be other people's children. Until our father returned, bearing defeated fruits and vegetables that bore no resemblance to those he had earlier enjoyed with such abandon. The message was that if something is free, you should take only the best. If, on the other hand, you're forced to pay, it's better to lower the bar and not be so choosy. Oh, quit your belly aching, he'd say, tossing a family pack of anemic pork chops into the cart. Meat is supposed to be gray. They doctor up the color for the ads and so forth, but there's nothing wrong with these. You'll see. I've never known our father to buy anything not marked reduced for quick sale. Without that orange tag, an item was virtually invisible to him. The problem was that he never associated quick sale with immediate consumption. Upon returning from the store, he would put the meat into the freezer, hide his favorite fruits and vegetables in the bathroom cabinet, and stuff everything else into the crisper. It was, of course, too late for crisp. But he took the refrigerator drawer at its word, insisting it was capable of reviving the dead and returning them, hale and vibrant, to the prime of their lives. Subjected to a few days in his beloved crisper, a carrot would become as pale and soft as a flaccid penis. Hey, he'd say, someone ought to eat this before it goes bad. He'd take a bite and the rest of us would wince at the unnatural silence. 2 weak to resist, the carrot quietly surrendered to the force of his jaws. An overcooked hot dog would have made more noise. Wiping the juice from his lips, he would insist that this was the best carrot he'd ever eaten. You guys don't know what you're missing. Oh, I think we had a pretty good idea. Even at our most selfish, we could understand why someone might be frugal with 6 children to support. We hoped our father might ease up and learn to treat himself once we all left home, but if anything, he's only gotten worse. Nothing will convince him that his fortunes might not suddenly reverse, reducing him to a diet of fingernail clippings or soups made from fallen leaves and flashlight batteries. The market will collapse or the crops will fail. Invading armies will go door to door, taking even our condiments, yet my father will tough it out. Retired now and living alone, he continues to eat like a scavenging bird. We used to return home for Christmas every year, my brothers, sisters, and I making it a point to call ahead, offering to bring whatever was needed for the traditional holiday meal. "No, I've already got the lamb," our father would say. "Grape leaves, phyllo dough, potatoes, I got everything on the list." "Yes, but when did you get these things?" An honest man, except when it comes to food, our father would lie, claiming to have just returned from the pricey new fresh market. "Did you get the beans?" we'd ask. "Well, sure I did." "Let me hear you snap one." Come Christmas Day, we would fly home to find a leg of lamb thawing beneath 6 inches of frost, the purchase date revealing that it had been bought midway through the Carter administration. Age had already mashed the potatoes, the grape leaves bore fur, and it was clear that when spoken to earlier on the phone, our father had snapped his fingers in imitation of a healthy green bean. "Why the long faces?" he'd ask. "It's Christmas Day. Cheer up, for Christ's sake." Tired of rancid oleo and perfectly good milk resembling blue cheese dressing, my family began taking turns hosting Christmas dinner. This past year, it was my turn, and those who could afford it agreed to join me in Paris. I met my father's plane at Charles de Gaulle, and as we were walking towards a taxi stand, a bag of peanuts fell from the pouch of his suitcase. These were not the peanuts handed out on his recent flight, but something acquired years earlier, back when all planes had propellers and pilots wore leather helmets and long flowing scarves. I picked up the bag and felt its contents crumple and turn to dust. "Give me those, will you?" My father tucked the peanuts inside his breast pocket, saving them for later. Back at the apartment, he unpacked. I thought the cat had defecated on my bed, until I realized that the object on my pillow was not a turd, but a shriveled black banana he'd brought all the way to Paris from its hiding place beneath the bathroom sink. "Here," he said, "I'll give you half of it." He'd brought a pear as well and had wrapped it in a plastic bag so that its pus wouldn't stain the clothing. The clothing he had packed the day earlier, but bought long before he was married. As with his food, my father is faithful to his wardrobe, operating on the assumption that sooner or later even the toga will make a comeback. He holds on to his clothing and continues to wear things long after they've begun to disintegrate. Included in his suitcase was a battered suede cap bought in Kansas City shortly after the war. This was the cap that would figure into his story later that night when we joined my sister and a few friends at a nice Paris restaurant. "So," he says, "I found this brown-colored something or other in my suitcase, and I must have chewed on the thing for a good 5 minutes until I realized I was eating the brim of my cap." "Can you beat that? A piece of it must have broken off during the flight, but hell, how was I supposed to know what it was?" My friend Maya finds this amusing. "So you literally ate your hat." "Well, yeah," he says, "but not the whole thing. I stopped after the first few bites. An outsider might think he stopped for practical reasons, but my sisters and I know better. Because it didn't kill him, the cap had proved edible, and would now be savored and appreciated in a different way. No longer considered an article of clothing, it would return to its native land, where it would move from the closet to the bathroom cabinet, joining the ranks of the spoiled to wait for the coming famine. Bend over and say, ah. Before coming to France, my worst nightmare was that something would go wrong and I'd be forced to visit a doctor. This fear had nothing to do with the state of French medicine in particular. Call me squeamish, but I didn't want to couple extreme physical pain with what even the kindest doctor would identify as a considerable language barrier. On the best of days, I talked not unlike Yoda, the donkey-eared gnome from the Dagobah system. Were someone to needlessly remove both of my kidneys, chances are that I would have accidentally instructed him to do so. I'd have no one but myself to blame, and that bothered me. Another fear had to do with money. The last time I'd visited a New York doctor, it had cost me $225 just to limp through the door. The spot diagnosis of housewife's knee had cost me another $150. And the anti-inflammatories had set me back even further. Shortly after moving into my Paris apartment, I noticed a leak in the bathroom and phoned the landlord to say, "The toilet, she cry much of the time." A plumber was sent, and after working for all of half an hour, he charged me $1,000 for a replacement. In New York, I could have gotten that same toilet for $300. Based on the price of a relatively minor plumbing problem, I figured that a Paris doctor would cost at least three times the price of a New York doctor. In order to pay the bill, I'd have to write a check, which would involve having to correctly spell a series of very high numbers. My fear of tumors is nothing compared to my fear of spelling, and so I made it a point to avoid plagues and try to remain as healthy as possible. Given all my assorted little phobias, it is unfortunate that my move to France coincided with what appears to be the systematic physical breakdown of my body. It started with my teeth, which I'd always hoped might eventually improve on their own. Preferably overnight while I was sleeping. In my mind, I'd just been to the dentist, but in fact, the child born on the day of my last checkup would now be 13 years old, with bleeding gums of his own. A French friend recommended a Dr. Jesmar, and when I could no longer manage to bite into a banana, I went. The bad news involved a bloody hook and the realization that the only thing holding my mouth together had been 2 inches of plaque. The good news was that my 45 minutes in the chair wound up costing the equivalent of $40, which is a great price for close to an hour of unrelenting pain. The first time I visited Dr. Jesmar, he went along and did most of the talking. The second and third time, I went alone and found that I did a fine job all by myself. I told her that when I had 15 years, I had worn a fence in my mouth. And then I continued, effectively asking such hard-hitting questions as, "If a tooth budges today, can he live in my mouth tomorrow?" And, "Are mine the most sick teeth you have seen in a lifetime?" The dentist laughed at my second question, saying, "Don't be silly. You've got the worst gums I've seen in years, but the teeth themselves are strong and healthy." After my third visit, she set me up with a periodontist named Dr. Geig and told me she'll be happy to cap whichever teeth he allows me to keep. My visits to the dentist left me confident enough to make an appointment with an eye doctor. From the time I had 5 years, I have worn of myself some glasses, I told him. Then, when I had 20 years, I said, enough of this. I am tired of something living all the time upon my nose. The doctor looked at his watch as I nattered on, explaining that after many years of lazy eyes, I was now ready to enter the door of good seeing. How do you think about that now? I got a new pair of glasses and I'm still adjusting to all the subtle things I've been missing all these years. Things like the expressions of disgust that traditionally cross people's faces when they discover that they're talking to an idiot. When I'd finished with the eye doctor, I made an appointment at a hospital specializing in dermatology and another word I couldn't quite make out. A word that turned out to mean venereal disease. I went hoping to have a harmless growth removed from beneath my left eye and was confused when the doctor instructed me to remove all of my clothing and lie naked upon the table. Can we say goodbye to the little red spot who live on my face, I asked. After examining me for syphilis and searching for missing children in my rectum, the doctor removed a mole from my leg and handed me a bill for $25. Can we please say goodbye to the little red spot who live on my face? I asked the receptionist. The woman made a follow-up appointment where, for another $25, a surgeon removed the growth from beneath my left eye and performed a biopsy on the ugly brown splotch that's taking over my nose. It was simple. I considered having a colonoscopy just for the fun of it. But it turned out that my next medical procedure was an unscheduled trip to the emergency room, where I learned the word for kidney stone. The one time I'd gone to a New York emergency room, I'd waited for close to 3 hours. Here in Paris, there was no line at all, and 5 minutes after my arrival, I was in a private room, enjoying an IV of glucose and Demerol. An attractive male nurse wrapped me in a blanket and wheeled me down to the radiology lab, where, floating high above the pain, I watched an episode of Charlie's Angels dubbed into French. When, at my request, this same male nurse brought me an ashtray, I knew that there was no real reason to ever return to the United States. At no point during my 4-hour stay did anyone ask if I had health insurance. I was instructed to sign nothing, and payment was not discussed until I brought it up myself. Pay, the doctor said. Oh, you can pay the next time you come in. Or I guess we could send you a bill. I asked if she had my address, and she said, no, but you can give it to me if you want to. It was as if everyone was on Demerol. My emergency room visit wound up costing me $100. Were I a French citizen, the government would reimburse all the money I've spent on my eyes, teeth, face, and kidneys. I'd be covered for everything, including the cost of medication. As it is, I'd have to have a heart transplant in order to meet the deductible on the worthless American health insurance I signed up for before leaving New York. The downside is that I have to pay my own French medical bills. The upswing is that the bills are so low, I can finally afford to be a hypochondriac. Which makes me so happy I could die. I'm just going to read a few little things here from my diary. Hugh and I spent the weekend in Normandy while his mother, Joan, stayed in Paris to take care of our cat. Before we left, she bought a bottle of wine, and I warned her that she might want to pick up a decent corkscrew because Hugh's is worthless. Every time I use it, I wind up pushing in the cork with a screwdriver. I return to Paris this afternoon, and shortly afterwards, Joan walked through the door, carrying a sack of groceries and a new corkscrew, the type with the two prongs. "Boy, you were right about that corkscrew of Hughes," she said. "I couldn't get it to do anything." When I pointed out that she'd just bought an exact replica of her son's corkscrew, she gave me a blank look, saying, "What are you talking about? I thought this was Hughes' corkscrew." She opened a drawer and pulled out a palm-sized plastic disc attached to a shallow coupling. "This part fits over the top of the bottle, but when I tried turning it towards the arrow, nothing happened." It was, for me, one of those adult moments involving a choice. Do you shrug your shoulders and say, "I couldn't get it to work either?" Or do you tell the woman she spent the weekend trying to open a wine bottle with the broken knob to the dishwasher? I chose the latter. Adding that the oven dials don't work that well either. "Oh," she said, "I feel so stupid. Just promise me you won't tell anybody about this." Me? Who would I tell? Before completion of the Channel Tunnel, it took some work to get to England, but now, with the Eurostar, it's only a 3-hour train ride from Paris to London. Hugh and I have made a half-dozen trips over the past year, and each time the city seems different. The London I visited at the beginning of the month was an extension of the Montague, my Bloomsbury hotel, located behind the British Museum. Designed by the firm of Poppins, Pooh, and Cratchit, it was... It was what I'd always expected England to be like. The lobby was like the inside of a jewelry box, with ornate padded walls and a lid-like ceiling you felt could be lifted off at any moment, revealing the moon-sized head of a delighted child. Flower arrangements and silver bowls of apples sat on polished mantels, flanked by crystal sconces and portraits of rosy-cheeked dukes dressed like girls in velvet coats and high lace collars. My room overlooked a private garden, and while it was a little too heavy for my taste, I certainly couldn't complain that I wasn't comfortable. The service, too, was excellent. Doormen dressed in bowlers seemed delighted by the opportunity to run into the driving rain in search of a cab, and the maid tracked me down to return the tip I'd left on my dresser. For lunch, we ate big bowls of sticky toffee pudding, followed by tea served with puck-sized scones. On the advice of a friend, we had dinner at a restaurant that prided itself on tail-to-snout cooking. Animals come in the back door and nothing leaves but a few fistfuls of hair. Hugh started with a roasted bone marrow and proceeded with an entree of warm pig's head served with butter beans. My comment being, "Well, thank God it's warm." Included on the menu was a side order of wet walnuts, potato and Wigmore pie, hake and lentils, boiled egg and celery, and something called winkles. The place wasn't cheap, but neither did it feel oppressively trendy, which is always a challenge when you're serving pig's head. I'd looked forward to returning, but the London of club chairs and hot roasted bone marrow was nowhere to be had on our last visit. This was a business trip, and in a misguided attempt to make me happy, my host booked me into something called the Hempel. There were rooms with beds, and people paid close to $400 to spend the night, but still I'd hesitate to call it a hotel. This was one of those fussy design temples brought to you by the same people who make bathrobes out of rubber, and stay up nights trying to reconfigure the fork. It was an architecture based on denial, the emphasis placed not on what a traveler might need, but rather on what he could live without, a list that ran the gamut from sunlight to doorknobs. Hugh guessed that the lobby was modeled after the Paris Holocaust Memorial, and he may have been right. There was no furniture, just a large granite cube which appeared to hover in space, reluctant to land as it might scuff the polished concrete floor. The former fireplaces had been stripped of their cozy mantles and turned into eternal gas flames that sputtered up from raked beds of bone-white gravel, leaving you with the impression that you'd arrived 5 minutes too late for a cremation. It was a cold and mournful place, the anti-pig's head, where, had there been one, the coat of arms might have pictured a single aspirin floating in a beaker of teardrops. Upstairs in our room, the main features were a stacked column of empty boxes and three Japanese plums arranged just so upon a piece of slate. Propped up on one of our two barren granite cubes was a sign reading, "Do not disturb," and I still can't figure out if it was left for us or the maid. It just wasn't the sort of place a person would live in. The bathroom sink was a deep stone trough that might have come in handy had we planned to stonewash a truckload of jeans, but wasn't terribly practical for shaving. The absence of a shower curtain meant that the floor was constantly covered in water, and I was so surprised it included a toilet that I couldn't bring myself to complain that it had a square seat. There may have been closets, but after an hour or so, I gave up looking and set my luggage beside the wall I hoped might open when it came time to say tally-ho. I called my sister Lisa last night after Hugh and I returned from London. Her husband Bob picked up, and I talked with the two of them until it was time for Bob's pies to come out of the oven. He got off the phone, and Lisa told me that a few days earlier she'd accidentally put a used Kotex through the wash. Bob had pulled it, clean and fluffy, from the dryer, and approached her saying, "Lisa, you're not supposed to wash these things, are you?" Lisa said she guessed not, and he continued, "And doesn't a person usually use two of them? I sorted through everything, but I guess he forgot to wash the other one." Lisa said, "The other what?" And Bob said, "Shoulder pads, silly! Isn't that what we just been talking about?" He handed her the clean, warm Kotex, and she placed it in her dresser drawer, wondering what he might have thought had she still been using tampons. Hugh and I went to a flea market on the outskirts of Paris with our American friend Kristen and a 25-year-old Israeli chef named Benjamin. He was a nice-looking guy with dark, thickly-lashed eyes that tended to bulge whenever he grew excited, which was often. At one point late in the afternoon, I swear I saw his pupils pop out and press themselves against his glasses like a pair of sea snails cleaving to the side of an aquarium. He didn't say much at the flea market, but opened up once we'd left and settled in at a cafe across the street from a nearby park. Benjamin's cell phone had rung repeatedly throughout the afternoon, and when I asked who'd been calling, he said he'd been having some problems with his best friend, a fellow Israeli named Avi. "I don't understand what is happening inside his head, but every day I am getting more confused with his stuff," he said. Benjamin learned English in high school and used the word "stuff" to replace any larger word or phrase he couldn't immediately bring to mind. The flea market was full of stuff, but so was the surrounding park. Socks were stuff that people wore on their feet, and gay sex was stuff he suspected his friend Avi was engaging in with other men. It was, he said, just a theory, but as long as Hugh and I were there, he wondered if we'd mind answering a few questions. "Seeing as you are in the business and stuff." He told us that for the past 4 years, Avi had had a string of girlfriends, each one more beautiful than the last. Then some stuff came up, leading Benjamin to wonder if these girlfriends weren't just some stuff his friend was using to cover stuff up with. "For example," he said, "lately Avi will call me on the phone at 3 o'clock in the morning and invite me to go to his house and join him in the bathtub." Is that normal? He says that he would like to do caresses with me, which seems like pretty strange stuff when you think about it. We agreed that it was a little out of the ordinary, and he continued. I tell Avi that I would just as soon have a shower or a bath at my own house, and he says that I am no kind of a friend. I go to his house to see him and say hello, and every time he comes to the door, he reaches for my chest and squeezes my nipple, which is not used to such kind of a treatment. Is this something he learned from the Americans, this stuff? Is this some kind of regular greeting I don't know about? I haven't been back to the States in a few months, but said that I doubted it was any kind of a new trend. Still, though, if Americans are now pushing themselves to work on collapsible scooters, I suppose anything is possible. And now there is this, Benjamin said. For the past month or so, whenever I go to Avi's house, he removes all of his clothing and walks around naked doing stuff. I say, what is going on here? And he tells me to relax and take my pants off. Do you think this means something? It was clear that this friendship meant a lot to Benjamin and that he was genuinely puzzled by Avi's behavior. I don't care what stuff he might be doing, he said. I just want to know for sure what is going on, and so I am asking you for your advice. Before moving to Paris, Benjamin had spent 4 years serving in his country's army. I ordered a second coffee and marveled that someone so naive had ever been allowed to carry a submachine gun. Kristen would tell me later that he hadn't just been an officer, he'd been an intelligence officer. A fact that doesn't inspire much hope for the future of Israel. Listen, I said. What you should do is tell your friend that you've slept with quite a few men yourself, but that you're only attracted to redheads. His eyeballs popped forward a few inches, and I attempted to settle him back down. I know it's not true, but you should say it anyway. Then the next time he calls you at 3 a.m. and offers to caress you in the bathtub, you should go over to his house. If he opens the door naked, grabs your nipple, and you notice that he's dyed his hair red, I think you can reasonably assume that he's in the business. Benjamin leaned back to seriously consider my suggestion, and I felt, if not old and wise, then at least incredibly old and cruel. I left my friend Evelyn's house at 4:30 this morning and walked a few blocks before flagging down a cab. The driver was a thin, butter-colored man with stained fingertips and dyed black hair that sat on his head like a small, shiny saddle. I stepped into the back seat and he asked me my name, saying, "So tell me, Dave, you seen any pussy out there tonight?" "I beg your pardon?" "Pussy, Dave, pussy. You seen any?" I said I hadn't noticed any, but then again, something might have slipped by while I wasn't looking. "A lot of times you can see some pussy walking further south on Montrose," he said, "but a lot of that is sick pussy." I said nothing, but still he continued, acting as though I'd been the one to start the conversation. "Of course it's a little cold out tonight, Dave. It's late, so a lot of that pussy is probably at home getting some sleep." He spoke as though a vagina had a mind of its own and the ability to move around as it saw fit. "If you're interested, I can give you a tip on some pretty nice pussy," he said. "First class all the way. It lives not far from here, and I'm pretty sure it's wide awake and raring to go." Again, it was a notion of independence that got to me. I pictured a vagina walking through the door of a realtor's office and arranging to rent an apartment. I know I put those references somewhere. "So what do you say, Dave? Are we on?" Having spent the last few weeks on college campuses, it was refreshing to hear someone make such an honest and open ass of himself. It didn't bother me that he so casually used the word pussy, but I was insulted by the automatic assumption that I was a heterosexual, trawling the streets for a vagina, either with or without its owner. If that's what this man saw when he looked in his rearview mirror, he obviously had no business driving a car or operating any machinery larger than a can opener. He asked again if we were on, and I said I would be, had my dick not taken off earlier in the evening. There's no telling where it is now, I said. And what's worse, I think the son of a bitch took my wallet. At the grocery store this evening, in the section devoted to foreign foods, I came across a large can of peanut butter, and it broke my heart. It's not something you traditionally find in France, and you could sense that someone had gone through a great deal of trouble to make this happen. The problem, of course, was the can. It seems that someone along the way might have pulled the manufacturer aside and pointed out that peanut butter is supposed to come in a jar. The can just made it seem all wrong. It was like buying a jug of dog food or a plastic bag of tuna fish. The items that come in cans are generally the things you use in one or two sittings. Cat food, baked beans, that type of thing. The French manufacturers obviously had the impression that homesick Americans just sit around with tablespoons and go through a pound of peanut butter in a single afternoon, shoveling it in until they pass out. The obese, grinning child pictured on the side of the can certainly gave that impression. Under normal circumstances, his likeness would appear only on a warning label. But to the makers of this peanut butter, he was a siren, the perfect calorie magnet for their targeted American audience. Hey, they expected us to say, he looks just like us. Let's get some of that. Everything about it was just wrong, and I left the store feeling depressed for everyone involved. It was the same way I'd felt last month after passing a graffitied letterbox reading, Fuck of, USA. The vandal should have expressed himself in French as a missing F took all the sting out of his intended message. Yankee go hum. It just doesn't work. I felt embarrassed for these people who had come close but ultimately failed at their threatening phrases in peanut butter. The embarrassment led to sorrow and was followed by a tinge of superiority that lasted until I remembered such American misfires as the French tickler and the croissandwich. They weren't my inventions, but still they caused me to feel foolish and guilty by association. Luckily, we had company coming for dinner, and I had things to do. Otherwise, I might have crawled to the nearest bar and lost myself in a dozen boxes of beer. I had a reading in Marin County and was driven up from San Francisco by a woman named Bridget. We were talking about the English and the savage nature of their criticism when she told me the following story. Pia Zadora, who is maybe the least talented actress in the world, was playing the title role in the London production of The Diary of Anne Frank. This apparently being the version in which the blonde, blue-eyed Anne whiles away her time doing bust exercises. According to Bridget, she was so bad that towards the end of the play, when the Nazis entered the stage, an audience member stood to shout, "She's in the attic!" Last night in Palm Beach, I read the little entry about Pia Zadora, and I can't recall ever getting a bigger laugh. I was laying in bed this morning, reliving the moment, when a stranger named Terry called to tell me that the story wasn't true. According to his sources, Pia Zadora has never appeared on the London stage, much less in the role of Anne Frank. The whole thing's a variation of an old George Burns joke that was later retooled for a TV program called The Golden Girls. When I thanked Terry for his call, I was genuine. Really, I was. The response had been great, but I swear I'll never read that thing again. I'm just not that type of person. My friend Abe went to Eastern Europe and stopped in Paris on his way back to San Diego. We were at the zoo watching the monkeys beat one another with sticks when he told me about a recent E. coli outbreak in Romania. A couple hundred people got sick and the government sent an agent to investigate. The source was eventually traced to a baker who'd been tainting his breads and pastries with the human feces they found hidden in his walk-in cooler, stored in a plastic bucket. My only question, Abe said, is why did he keep the bucket of shit in the refrigerator? I mean, what? Did he worry it would go bad? My friend James loaned me a cookbook called Imperial Dishes of China, and I found myself reading it as though it were a collection of perfectly titled short stories. 100 Birds Paying Homage to the Phoenix was a little drawn out, but coming in at a simple page and a half, Monkey Heads on a Pine Tree was a masterpiece of suspense and efficiency. In France, I often leaf through cookbooks in search of vocabulary words I think might come in handy. It's how I learned the verbs to simmer, to dice, and to set aside the beak. The Imperial Dishes cookbook was in English, but still I felt as though I came away with something valuable. Here were instructions such as, rinse the lips twice in cold water, and remove the penis and carve it into bite-sized pieces. The dietary issues aside, it was alarming to read such things in the form of a direct order. Scald the vagina and remove any remaining hairs sounds as if it were taken straight from the sociopath's instruction manual. As a work of fiction, Imperial Dishes was enormously entertaining, but as an actual working cookbook, I felt that it left a few too many holes. A homosexual's notion of bite-sized penis is no doubt dramatically different than that of, say, an Orthodox rabbi. It's just not specific enough. When told to, quote, arrange the camel paw attractively, my first question was, how? Camel paws don't even look attractive on camels. On top of that, where are you supposed to buy these ingredients in the first place? If you can't locate a single camel paw, can you use 2 dozen cat paws instead? While one can easily find the ingredients for a pipe bomb, it isn't that easy to get your hands on a disembodied penis. And what's an acceptable substitute for a vagina? I'd really like to know, as my brother would pay handsomely for that information. The questions are frustrating, but all in all, that's what I liked about Imperial Dishes of China. It made me think. This is a little something I wrote. I've been doing a lot of writing for Esquire lately, and I wrote some poems about dogs. I don't have dogs of my own, and these are just a few of the many. Pepper, Spot, and Leopold were sent by God, so I've been told, in hopes we might all comprehend that every dog is man's best friend. Most every evening, Goldilocks snacks from Kitty's litter box. Then on command, she gives her missus lots of little doggy kisses. The Deaver's errant pit bull Cass bit the postman on the ass. Her lower teeth destroyed his sphincter. Now his walk's a bit distincter. A naughty St. Bernard named Don finds Polly's Kotex in the John. He holds the blood stake in his jaws and mourns her coming menopause. Dachshund Skip from Winnipeg loves to hump his master's leg. Every time he gets it up, he stains Bill's calves with unborn puppy. Each night old Bowser licks his balls, then falls asleep till nature calls. He poops a stool, then, though it's heinous, bends back down and licks his anus. A million bubbles. It wasn't anything I'd planned on, but at the age of 22, after dropping out of my second college and traveling back and forth across the country a few times, I found myself back in Raleigh, North Carolina, living in my parents' basement. After 6 months spent waking at noon, getting high, and listening to the same Joni Mitchell record over and over again, my father called me into his den and told me to get out. He was sitting very formally in a big, comfortable chair behind his desk, and I felt as though he was firing me from the job of being his son. I'd seen this coming, and it honestly didn't bother me all that much. The way I saw it, being kicked out of the house was just what I needed if I was ever going to get back on my feet. "Fine," I said. "I'll go. But one day you'll be sorry." I had no idea what I meant by this. It just seemed like the sort of thing a person should say when being told to leave. My sister Lisa had an apartment over by the university and said that I could come stay with her as long as I didn't bring my Joni Mitchell record. My mother offered to drive me over, and after a few bong hits, I took her up on it. It was a 15-minute trip across town, and on the way, my mother and I listened to the rebroadcast of a radio call-in show in which people phoned the host to describe the various birds gathered around their backyard feeders. Normally, the show came on in the morning, and it seemed strange to listen to it at night. The birds in question had gone to bed hours ago and probably had no idea they were still being talked about. I chewed this over and wondered if anyone back at the house was talking about me. To the best of my knowledge, no one had ever tried to imitate my voice or describe the shape of my head, and it was depressing that I went unnoticed while a great many people seemed willing to drop everything for a cardinal. My mother pulled up in front of my sister's apartment building, and when I opened the car door, she started to cry, which worried me because she normally didn't do things like that. It wasn't one of those I'm-going-to-miss-you things, but something sadder and more desperate than that. I wouldn't know it until months later, but my father had kicked me out of the house not because I was a bum, but because I was gay. Our little talk was supposed to be one of those defining moments that shapes a person's adult life, but he'd been so uncomfortable with the most important word that he left it out completely, saying only, "I think we both know why I'm doing this." I guess I could have nailed him down. I just hadn't seen the point. Is it because I'm a failure? A drug addict? A sponge? Come on, Dad, just give me one good reason. My mother assumed that I knew the truth, and it tore her apart. Here was yet another defining moment, and again I missed it entirely. She cried until it sounded as if she were choking. "I'm sorry," she said. "I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry." I figured that within a few weeks I'd have a job in some crummy little apartment. It didn't seem insurmountable, but my mother's tears made me worry that finding these things might be a little harder than I thought. Did she honestly think I was that much of a loser? "Really," I said, "I'll be fine." The car light was on, and I wondered what the passing drivers thought as they watched my mother sob. What kind of people did they think we were? Did they think she was one of those crybaby moms who fell apart every time someone chipped a coffee cup? Did they assume I'd said something to hurt her, Did they see us as just another crying mother and her stoned gay son? Sitting in a station wagon and listening to a call-in show about birds? Or did they imagine, for just one moment, that we might be special? Thank you very much for coming tonight. Thanks.
This has been a Time Warner Audiobooks production of Me Talk Pretty One Day, written by David Sedaris and read by the author.
I'm not so incredibly exhausting to listen to as I used to be.
Produced, directed, and essays selected by Maya Thomas.
And she's a wonderful bitch.
Original music by Mark Levinson. Production coordinated by Dennis Kao. Edited, mixed, and mastered by Martin Royer at Data Sound.
That sounded good, didn't it? Yeah? You know, normally, I don't make mistakes. I mean, no. Reading out loud, I don't stumble, I don't trip up, I don't make mistakes. But as long as if I know that there's a tape recorder running, then I'm just a mess.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.